stories could rouse him to hope. He rejoiced the more, therefore, when his son Philip telephoned him from Worcester. "Be home Sunday? Marilla's in New York, gadding, and I'm all alone here. Thought I'd just drive up for the day and see how things are in your neck of the woods." "Come on, splendid, so long since we've seen you. I'll have your mother start a pot of beans right away." Doremus was happy. Not for some time did his cursed two-way-mindedness come to weaken his joy, as he wondered whether it wasn't just a myth held over from boyhood that Philip really cared so much for Emma's beans and brown bread, and wondered just why it was that up-to-date Americans like Philip always used the long-distance telephone rather than undergo the dreadful toil of dictating a letter a day or two earlier. It didn't really seem so efficient, the old-fashioned village editor reflected, to spend 75 cents on a telephone call in order to save 5 cents worth of time. "Oh, hush. Anyway, I'll be delighted to see the boy. I'll bet there isn't a smarter young lawyer in Worcester. There's one member of the family that's a real success." He was a little shocked when Philip came, like a one-man procession, into the living room late on Saturday afternoon. He had been forgetting how bald this upstanding young advocate was growing, even at 34, and it seemed to him that Philip was a little heavy and senatorial in speech, and a bit too cordial. "By Jove, Dad! You don't know how good it is to be back in the old digs. Mother and the girls upstairs? By Jove, sir, that was a horrible business, the killing of poor Fowler. Horrible. I was simply horrified. There must have been a mistake somewhere, because Judge Swan has a wonderful reputation for scrupulousness." "There was no mistake. Swan is a fiend, literally." Doremus sounded less paternal than when he had first bounded up to shake hands with the beloved prodigal. "Really? Oh, we must talk it over. I'll see if there can't be a stricter investigation. Swan, really. We'll certainly go into the whole business, but first I must just skip upstairs and give Mammy a good smack and Mary and little sis." That was the last time that Philip mentioned Effingham Swan or any stricter investigation of the acts thereof. All afternoon he was relentlessly filial and fraternal, and he smiled like an automobile salesman when Sissy griped at him, "What's the idea of all the tender hand-dusting, Philco?" Doremus and he were not alone till nearly midnight. They sat upstairs in the sacred study. Philip lighted one of Doremus's excellent cigars as though he were a cinema actor, playing the role of a man lighting an excellent cigar, and breathed amiably, "Well, sir, this is an excellent cigar. It certainly is excellent." "Why not?" "Oh, I just mean, I was just appreciating it." "What is it, Phil? There's something on your mind. Shoot. Not rowing with Marilla, are you?"
"Certainly not. Most certainly not. Oh, I don't approve of everything Mary does. She's a little extravagant, but she's got a heart of gold. And let me tell you, Pater, there isn't a young society woman in Worcester that makes a nicer impression on everybody, especially at nice dinner parties." "Well, then, let's have it, Phil. Something serious?"
"Yes, I'm afraid there is. Look, Dad, oh, do sit down and be comfortable. I've been awfully perturbed to hear that you're in slightly bad odor with some of the authorities."
"You mean the corpos?"
"Naturally. Who else?"
"Maybe I don't recognize them as authorities."
"Oh, listen, Pater, please don't joke tonight. I'm serious. As a matter of fact, I hear you're more than just slightly in wrong with them."
"And who may your informant be?"
"Oh, just letters, old school friends."
"Now, you aren't really pro corpo, are you?"
"How did you ever guess?"
"Well, I didn't vote for Windrip, personally, but I begin to see where I was wrong. I can see now that he has not only great personal magnetism, but real constructive power, real sure enough statesmanship. Some say it's Lee Saracen's doing, but don't you believe it for a minute. Look at all Buzz did back in his home state, before he ever teamed up with Saracen.
And some say Winthrop is crude. Well, so were Lincoln and Jackson. Now, what I think of Winthrop, the only thing you ought to think of Winthrop is that his gangsters murdered your fine brother-in-law, and plenty of other men just as good. Do you condone such murders?
No, certainly not. How can you suggest such a thing, Dad? No one abhors violence more than I do. Still, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs.
Hell and damnation!
Why, Pater,
don't call me Pater. If I ever hear that can't-make-an-omelet phrase again, I'll start doing a little murder myself. It's used to justify every atrocity under every despotism, fascist or Nazi or communist or American labor war. Omelet, eggs. By God, sir, men's souls and blood are not eggshells for tyrants to break. Oh, sorry, sir, I guess maybe the phrase is a little shop-worn. I just mean to say, I'm just trying to figure this situation out realistically.
Realistically? That's another buttered bun to excuse murder.
But honestly, you know, horrible things do happen, thanks to the imperfection of human nature, but you can forgive the means if the end is a rejuvenated nation that
I can do nothing of the kind.
I can never forgive evil and lying and cruel means, and still less can I forgive fanatics that use that for an excuse. If I may imitate Romain Rolland, a country that tolerates evil means, evil manners, standards of ethics, for a generation will be so poisoned that it never will have any good end. I'm just curious, but do you know how perfectly you're quoting every Bolshevik apologist that sneers at decency and kindness and truthfulness in daily dealings as bourgeois morality? I hadn't understood that you'd gone quite so Marxo-materialistic.
I? Marxian? Good God!
Doremus was pleased to see that he had stirred his son out of his, if your honor please, smugness.
Why, one of the things I most admire about the Corpos is that, as I know absolutely, I have reliable information from Washington, they have saved us from a simply ghastly invasion by Red agents of Moscow. Communists pretending to be decent labor leaders.
Not really. Had the fool forgotten that his father was a newspaper man and not likely to be impressed by reliable information from Washington?
Really? And to be realistic. Sorry, sir, if you don't like the word, but to be realistic. Well, yes then.
Doremus recalled such tempers in Philip from years ago. Had he been wise, after all, to restrain himself from the domestic pleasure of licking the brat?
The whole point is that Winthrop, or anyway the Corpos, are here to stay, Pater, and we've got to base our future actions not on some desired utopia, but on what we really and truly have. And think of what they've actually done. Just, for example, how they've removed the advertising billboards from the highways and ended unemployment and their simply stupendous feat in getting rid of all crime.
Good God.
Pardon me? What'd you say, Dad?
Nothing. Nothing. Go on.
But I begin to see now that the Corpo gains haven't been just material, but spiritual.
Eh?
Really? They've revitalized the whole country. Formerly, we had gotten pretty sordid, just thinking about material possessions and comforts, about electric refrigeration and television and air conditioning. Kind of lost the sturdiness that characterized our pioneer ancestors. Why, ever so many young men were refusing to take military drill, and the discipline and willpower and good fellowship that you only get from military training...
Pardon me. I forgot you were a pacifist.
Doremus grimly muttered, "Not anymore." Of course, there must be any number of things we can't agree on, Dad. But after all, as a publicist, you ought to listen to the voice of youth.
You? Youth? You're not youth. You're 2,000 years old mentally. You date just about 100 B.C. in your fine new imperialistic theories.
No, but you must listen, Dad.
Why do you suppose I came clear up here from Worcester just to see you?
God only knows.
I want to make myself clear. Before Windrip, we'd been lying down in America while Europe was throwing off all her bonds. Both monarchy and this antiquated parliamentary democratic liberal system that really means rule by professional politicians and by egotistic intellectuals. We've got to catch up to Europe again, got to expand. It's the rule of life. A nation, like a man, has to go ahead or go backward, always.
I know, Phil. I used to write that same thing in those same words back before 1914.
Did you? Well, anyway, got to expand. Why, what we ought to do is to grab all of Mexico and maybe Central America and a good big slice of China. Why, just on their own behalf we ought to do it, misgoverned the way they are. Maybe I'm wrong, but impossible. Windrip and Saracen and Dewey Hake and McGoblin, all those fellows, they're big. They're making me stop and think. And now to come down to my errand here. You think I ought to run the Informer according to corpo theology?
Why, yes. That was approximately what I was going to say.
I just don't see why you haven't been more reasonable about this whole thing, you with your quick mind. After all, the time for selfish individualism is gone. We've got to have mass action, one for all and all for one.
Philip,
would you mind telling me what the deuce you're really heading toward? Cut the cackle.
Well, since you insist to cut the cackle, as you call it, not very politely, seems to me, seeing I've taken the trouble to come clear up from Worcester, I have reliable information that you're going to get into mighty serious trouble if you don't stop opposing, or at least markedly failing to support, the government.
All right. What of it? It's my serious trouble.
That's just the point. It isn't. I do think that just for once in your life you might think of Mother and the girls, instead of always of your own selfish ideas that you're so proud of. In a crisis like this, it just isn't funny any longer to pose as a quaint liberal.
Doremus's voice was like a firecracker.
Cut the cackle, I told you. What you after? What's the corpo gang to you?
I have been approached in regard to the very high honor of an assistant military judgeship, but your attitude as my father...
Philip, I rather think, that I give you my parental curse, not so much because you are a traitor, as because you have become a stuffed shirt. Good night.
Chapter 25 Holidays were invented by the devil to coax people into the heresy that happiness can be won by taking thought. What was planned as a rackety day for David's first Christmas with his grandparents was, they saw too well, perhaps David's last Christmas with them. Mary had hidden her weeping, but the day before Christmas, when Shad Ledoux tramped in to demand of Doremus whether Carl Paschal had ever spoken to him of communism, Mary came on Shad in the hall, stared at him, raised her hand like a boxing cat, and said with dreadful quietness, "You murderer! I shall kill you and kill Swan." For once, Shad did not look amused. To make the holiday as good an imitation of mirth as possible, they were very noisy, but their holly, their tinsel stars on a tall pine tree, their family devotion in a serene old house in a little town, was no different at heart from despairing drunkenness in the city night. Doremus reflected that it might have been just as well for all of them to get drunk and let themselves go, elbows on slopped cafe tables, as to toil at this pretense of domestic bliss. He now had another thing for which to hate the corpos, for stealing the secure affection of Christmas. For noon dinner, Louis Rotenstern was invited because he was a lorn bachelor and, still more, because he was a Jew, now insecure and snubbed and threatened in an insane dictatorship. There is no greater compliment to the Jews than the fact that the degree of their unpopularity is always the scientific measure of the cruelty and silliness of the regime under which they live, so that even a commercial-minded, money-fondling, heavily humorous Jew burger like Rotenstern is still a sensitive meter of barbarism. After dinner came Buck Titus, David's most favorite person, bearing staggering amounts of Woolworth tractors and fire engines and a real bow and arrow, and he was raucously insisting that Mrs. Candy dance with him what he not very precisely called the light fantastic, when the hammering sounded at the door. Eris Dilly tramped in with four men.
"Looking for Rotenstern. Oh, that you, Louis? Get your coat and come on. Orders."
"What's the idea? What do you want of him? What's the charge?" demanded Buck, still standing with his arm about Mrs. Candy's embarrassed waist.
"Dunno's there be any charges. Just ordered to headquarters for questionin'. District Commissioner Reek in town. Just askin' few people a few questions. Come on, you."
The hilarious celebrants did not, as they had planned, go out to Lorinda's tavern for skiing. Next day they heard that Rotenstern had been taken to the concentration camp at Trianon, along with that crabbed old Tory, Raymond Pridewell, the hardware dealer. Both imprisonments were incredible. Rotenstern had been too meek, and if Pridewell had not ever been meek, if he had constantly and testily and loudly proclaimed that he had not cared for Ledoux as a hired man and now cared even less for him as a local governor, yet, why, Pridewell was a sacred institution. As well think of dragging the Brownstone Baptist Church to prison. Later, a friend of Shad Ledoux took over Rotenstern's shop. "It can happen here," meditated Doremus. "It could happen to him. How soon? Before he should be arrested, he must make amends to his conscience by quitting the informer." Professor Victor Loveland, once a classicist of Isaiah College, having been fired from a labor camp for incompetence in teaching arithmetic to lumberjacks, was in town with wife and babies on his way to a job clerking in his uncle's slate quarry near Fairhaven. He called on Doremus and was hysterically cheerful. He called on Clarence Little, dropped in to visit with him, Clarence would have said. Now that twitchy, intense jeweler, Clarence, who had been born on a Vermont farm and had supported his mother till she died when he was 30, had longed to go to college and especially to study Greek. Though Loveland was his own age, in the mid-30s, he looked on him as a combination of Keats and Little. His greatest moment had been hearing Loveland read Homer. Loveland was leaning on the counter.
"Gone ahead with your Latin grammar, Clarence?"
"Golly, Professor, it just doesn't seem worthwhile anymore. I guess I'm kind of a weak sister anyway, but I find that these days it's about all I can do to keep going."
"Me too. And don't call me Professor. I'm a timekeeper in the slate quarry. What a life."
They had not noticed the clumsy-looking man in plain clothes who had just come in. Presumably he was a customer. But he grumbled, "So you two pansies don't like the way things go nowadays. Don't suppose you like the corpos. Don't think much of the chief." He jabbed his thumb into Loveland's ribs so painfully that Loveland yelped, "I don't think about him at all."
"Oh, you don't, eh? Well, you two fairies can come along to the courthouse with me."
"And who may you be?"
"Oh, just an ensign in the MMs, that's all."
He had an automatic pistol. Loveland was not beaten much because he managed to keep his mouth shut. But Little was so hysterical that they laid him on a kitchen table and decorated his naked back with 40 slashes of a steel ramrod. They had found that Clarence wore yellow silk underwear, and the MMs from factory and plowland laughed, particularly one broad young inspector who was rumored to have a passionate friendship with a battalion leader from Nashua who was fat, eyeglassed, and high-pitched of voice. Little had to be helped into the truck that took Loveland and him to the Trianon concentration camp. One eye was closed and so surrounded with bruised flesh that the MM driver said it looked like a Spanish omelet. The truck had an open body, but they could not escape because the three prisoners on this trip were chained hand to hand. They lay on the floor of the truck. It was snowing. The third prisoner was not much like Loveland or Little. His name was Ben Trippin. He had been a millhand for Madary Coal. He cared no more about the Greek language than did a baboon, but he did care for his six children. He had been arrested for trying to strike coal and for cursing the Corpo regime when coal had reduced his wages from $9 a week in pre-Corpo currency to $7.50. As to Loveland's wife and babies, Lorinda took them in till she could pass the hat and collect enough to send them back to Mrs. Loveland's family on a rocky farm in Missouri. But then things went better. Mrs. Loveland was favored by the Greek proprietor of a lunchroom and got work washing dishes and otherwise pleasing the proprietor, who brilliantined his mustache. The county administrator, in a proclamation signed by Emil Staubmeier, announced that they were going to regulate the agriculture on the submarginal land high up on Mount Terror. As a starter, half a dozen of the poorer families were moved into the large, square, quiet old house of that large, square, quiet old farmer, Henry Veeder, cousin of Doremus Jessup. These poorer families had many children, a great many, so that there were four or five persons bedded on the floor in every room of the home where Henry and his wife had placidly lived alone since their own children had grown. Henry did not like it and said so, not very tactfully, to the MMs herding the refugees. What was worse, the dispossessed did not like it any better. "'Tain't much, but we got a house of our own. Dunno why we should get shoved in on Henry," said one. "Don't expect other folks to bother me, and don't expect to bother other folks. Never did like that fool kind of yellow color Henry painted his barn, but guess that's his business." So Henry and two of the regulated agriculturists were taken to the Trianon concentration camp, and the rest remained in Henry's house, doing nothing but finish up Henry's large larder and wait for orders. "And before I'm sent to join Henry and Carl and Loveland, I'm going to clear my skirts," Doremus vowed, along in late January. He marched in to see County Commissioner Ledoux. "I want to quit the informer. Staubmeier has learned all I can teach him."
"Staubmeier? Oh, you mean Assistant Commissioner Staubmeier?"
"Chuck it, will you? We're not on parade and we're not playing soldiers. Mind if I sit down?"
"Don't look like you cared a hell of a lot whether I mind or not. But I can tell you right here and now, Jessup, without any monkey business about it, you're not going to leave your job. I guess I could find enough grounds for sending you to Trianon for about 1,000,000 years with 90 lashes, but you've always been so stuck on yourself as such an all-fired honest editor, it kind of tickles me to watch you kissing the chief's foot. And mine. I'll do no more of it, that's certain, and I admit that I deserve your scorn for ever having done it." "Well, isn't that elegant? But you'll do just what I tell you to and like it."
"Jessup, I suppose you think I had a swell time when I was your hired man, watching you and your old woman and the girls go off on a picnic while I—"
"Oh, I was just your hired man with dirt in my ears. Your dirt. I could stay home and clean up the basement."
"Maybe we didn't want you along, Shad. Good morning." Shad laughed. There was a sound of the gates of Trianon concentration camp in that laughter. It was really Sissy who gave Doremus his lead. He drove to Hanover to see Shad's superior, District Commissioner John Sullivan Reek, that erstwhile jovial and red-faced politician. He was admitted after only half an hour's waiting. He was shocked to see how pale and hesitant and frightened Reek had become, but the commissioner tried to be authoritative.
"Well, Jessup, what can I do for you?"
"May I be frank?"
"What? What? Oh, why, certainly. Frankness has always been my middle name."
"I hope so.
"Governor, I find I'm of no use on the informer at Fort Beulah. As you probably know, I've been breaking in Emil Staubmeyer as my successor. Well, he's quite competent to take hold now, and I want to quit. I'm really just in his way."
Why don't you stick around and see what you can still do to help him? There'll be little jobs cropping up from time to time.
Because it's got on my nerves to take orders where I used to give them for so many years. You can appreciate that, can't you?
My God, can I appreciate it? And how?
Well, I'll think it over. You wouldn't mind writing little pieces for my own little sheet at home? I own part of a paper there.
No, sure, delighted.
Does this mean that Reek believes the corpo tyranny is going to blow up in a revolution, so that he's beginning to trim? Or just that he's fighting to keep from being thrown out?
Yes, I can see how you might feel, Brother Jessup.
Thanks. Would you mind giving me a note to County Commissioner Ledoux, telling him to let me out without prejudice? Making it pretty strong.
No, not a bit. Just wait a minute, old fellow. I'll write it right now.
Doremus made as little ceremony as possible of leaving the informer, which had been his throne for 37 years. Staubmeyer was patronizing. Doc Itchett looked quizzical, but the chapel, headed by Dan Wilgus, shook hands profusely. And so at 62, stronger and more eager than he had been in all his life, Doremus had nothing to do more important than eating breakfast and telling his grandson stories about the elephant. But that lasted less than a week. Avoiding suspicion from Emma and Sissy and even from Buck and Lorinda, he took Julian aside. "Look here, boy. I think it's time now for me to begin doing a little high treason. Heaven's sake, keep all of this under your hat. Don't even tip off Sissy. I guess you know the communists are too theocratic for my tastes. But looks to me as though they have more courage and devotion and smart strategy than anybody since the early Christian martyrs, whom they also resemble in hairiness and the fondness for catacombs. I want to get in touch with them and see if there's any dirty work at the crossroads I can do for them. Say, distributing a few early Christian tracts by St. Lenin. But of course, theoretically, the communists have all been imprisoned. Could you get to Carl Pascal in Trianon and find out whom I could see? Said Julian, I think I could. Dr. Olmsted gets called in there sometimes on cases. They hate him because he hates them, but still, their camp doctor is a drunken bum, and they have to have a real doc in when one of their warders busts his wrist beating up some prisoner. I'll try, sir. 2 days afterward, Julian returned. My God, what a sewer that Trianon place is. I'd waited for Olmsted before in the car, but I never had the nerve to butt inside. The buildings... They were nice buildings, quite pretty, when the girls' school had them. Now the fittings are all torn out, and they've put up wallboard partitions for cells, and the whole place stinks of carbolic acid and excrement. And the air, well, there isn't any, you feel as if you were nailed up in a box. I don't know how anybody lives in one of those cells for an hour. And yet there's 6 men bunked in a cell 12 feet by 10, with a ceiling only 7 feet high and no light except a 25-watt, I guess it is, bulb in the ceiling. You couldn't read by it. But they get out for exercise 2 hours a day, walk around and around the courtyard. They're all so stooped, and they all look so ashamed, as if they'd had the defiance just licked out of them. Even Carl a little, and you remember how proud and sort of sardonic he was. Well, I got to see him, and he says to get in touch with this man. Here, I wrote it down. And for God's sake, burn it up soon as you've memorized it. Was he, had they...
Oh, yes, they've beaten him all right. He wouldn't talk about it, but there was a scar right across his cheek, from his temple right down to his chin. And I had just a glimpse of Henry Veeder. Remember how he looked? Like an oak tree? Now he twitches all the time and jumps and gasps when he hears a sudden sound. He didn't know me. I don't think he'd know anybody.
Doremus announced to his family, and told it loudly in Gath, that he was still looking for an option on an apple orchard to which they might retire.
and he journeyed southward with pajamas and a toothbrush and the first volume of Spengler's Decline of the West in a briefcase. The address given by Carl Paschal was that of a most gentlemanly dealer in altar cloths and priestly robes, who had his shop and office over a tea room in Hartford, Connecticut. He talked about the cembalo and the spinetta di serenata and the music of Palestrina for an hour before he sent Doremus on to a busy engineer constructing a dam in New Hampshire, who sent him to a tailor in a side street shop in Lynn, who at last sent him to northern Connecticut and to the eastern headquarters of what was left of the communists in America. Still carrying his little briefcase, he walked up a greasy hill, impassable to any motor car, and knocked at the faded green door of a squat New England farm cottage masked in wintry old lilac bushes and spirea shrubs. A stringy farm wife opened and looked hostile.
"I'd like to speak to Mr. Ailey, Mr. Bailey, or Mr. Cayley." "None of 'em home. You'll have to come again."
"Then I'll wait. What else should one do these days?"
"All right, come in."
"Thanks. Give them this letter." The tailor had warned him,
"It will all sound very foolish, the passports and everything, but if any of the Central Committee gets caught..."
He made a squirting sound and drew his scissors across his throat. Doremus sat now in a tiny hall off a flight of stairs steep as the side of a roof, a hall with sprigged wallpaper and Currier and Ives prints and black-painted wooden rocking chairs with calico cushions. There was nothing to read but a Methodist hymnal and a desk dictionary. He knew the former by heart, and anyway he always loved reading dictionaries. Often had one seduced him from editorial writing. Happily he sat, conning. Phenol, noun, chemical. The univalent radical C6H5, regarded as the basis of numerous benzene derivatives, as phenyl hydroxide, C6H5OH. Ferrocratian, noun, a choriambic trimeter catalectic, or catalectic glyconic, composed of a spondee, a choriambus, and a catalectic syllable.
"Well, I never knew any of that before. I wonder if I do now," thought Doremus contentedly,
before he realized that glowering from a very narrow doorway was a very broad man with wild gray hair and a patch over one eye. Doremus recognized him from pictures. He was Bill Atterbury, miner, longshoreman, veteran IWW leader, old AFL strike leader, 5 years in San Quentin and 5 honored years in Moscow, and reputed now to be the secretary of the illegal Communist Party.
"I'm Mr. Ailey. What can I do for you?" Bill demanded.
He led Doremus into a musty back room where, at a table which was probably mahogany underneath the scars and the clots of dirt, sat a squat man with kinky tow-colored hair and with deep wrinkles in the thick pale skin of his face, and a slender young elegant who suggested Park Avenue.
"How are you?"
said Mr. Bailey in a Russian-Jewish accent. Of him Doremus knew nothing save that he was not named Bailey. "Morning," snapped Mr. Cayley, whose name was Elfrey, if Doremus guessed rightly, and who was the son of a millionaire private banker, the brother of one explorer, one bishop's wife, and one countess, and himself a former teacher of economics in the University of California. Doremus tried to explain himself to these hard-eyed, quick-glancing plotters of ruin.
"Are you willing to become a party member in the extremely improbable case that they accept you, and to take orders, any orders, without question?"
asked Elfrey so suavely.
"Do you mean, am I willing to kill and steal?" "You've been reading detective stories about the Reds."
"No. What you'd have to do would be much more difficult than the amusement of using a Tommy gun. Would you be willing to forget you ever were a respectable newspaper editor, giving orders, and walk through the snow dressed like a bum to distribute seditious pamphlets, even if, personally, you should believe the pamphlets were of no slightest damn good to the cause?"
Why, I don't know.
Seems to me that as a newspaper man of quite a little training...
Hell, our only trouble is keeping out the trained newspapermen. What we need is trained bill posters that like the smell of flour paste and hate sleeping.
And, but you're a little old for this. Crazy fanatics that go out and start strikes, knowing they'll get beaten up and thrown in the bullpen.
No, I guess I... look here, I'm sure Walt Trowbridge will be joining up with the socialists and some of the left-wing radical ex-senators and farmer laborites and so on.
Bill Atterbury guffawed. It was a tremendous, somehow terrifying blast.
Yes, I'm sure they'll join up. All the dirty, sneaking, half-headed reformist social fascists like Trowbridge, that are doing the work of the capitalists and working for war against Soviet Russia without even having sense enough to know they're doing it, and to collect good pay for their crookedness.
I admire Trowbridge, snarled Doremus.
You would.
Elfrey rose, almost cordial, and dismissed Doremus with, Mr. Jessup, I was brought up in a sound bourgeois household myself, unlike these two roughnecks, and I appreciate what you're trying to do, even if they don't. I imagine that your rejection of us is even firmer than our rejection of you.
That's right, Comrade Elfrey. Both you and this fellow got ants in your bourgeois pants, like your Hugh Johnson would say, chuckled the Russian, Mr. Bailey.
But I just wonder if Walt Trowbridge won't be chasing out Buzz Windrip while you boys are still arguing about whether Comrade Trotsky was once guilty of saying mass facing the north.
Good day, said Doremus.
When he recounted it to Julian 2 days later, and Julian puzzled, I wonder whether you won or they did. Doremus asserted, I don't think anybody won, except the ants. Anyway, now I know that man is not to be saved by black bread alone, but by everything that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord our God. Communists, intense and narrow, Yankees, tolerant and shallow. No wonder a dictator can keep us separate and all working for him. Even in the 1930s, when it was radiantly believed that movies and the motor car and glossy magazines had ended the provinciality of all the larger American villages, in such communities as Fort Beulah, all the retired businessmen who could not afford to go to Europe or Florida or California, such as Doremus, were as aimless as an old dog on Sunday afternoon with the family away. They poked uptown to the shops, the hotel lobbies, the railway station, and at the barber shop were pleased rather than irritated when they had to wait a quarter hour for the tri-weekly shave. There were no cafes, as there would have been in continental Europe, and no club save the country club, and that was chiefly a sanctuary for the younger people in the evening and late afternoons. The superior Doremus Jessup, the bookman, was almost as dreary in retirement as banker Crowley would have been. He did pretend to play golf, but he could not see any particular point in stopping a good walk to wallop small balls, and, worse, the links were now bright with MM uniforms, and he hadn't enough brass, as no doubt Medary Cole would have, to feel welcome hour on hour in the Hotel Wessex lobby. He stayed in his third-story study and read as long as his eyes would endure it. But he irritably felt Emma's irritation and Mrs. Candy's ire at having a man around the house all day. Yes, he'd get what he could for the house and for what small share in informer stock the government had left him when they had taken it over. And go, well, just go, the Rockies or anywhere that was new. But he realized that Emma did not at all wish to go new places, and realized that the Emma to whose billowy warmth it had been comforting to come home after the office bored him and was bored by him when he was always there. The only difference was that she did not seem capable of admitting that one might, without actual fiendishness or any signs of hot-footing it for Reno, be bored by one's faithful spouse.
"Why don't you drive out and see Buck or Lorinda?" she suggested.
"Don't you ever get a little jealous of my girl, Linda?" he said, very lightly, because he very heavily wanted to know. She laughed.
"You, at your age? As if anybody thought you could be a lover."
"Well, Lorinda thought so," he raged, and promptly he did drive out and see her, a little easier in mind about his divided loyalties. Only once did he go back to the Informer office. Staubmeyer was not in sight, and it was evident that the real editor was that sly bumpkin, Doc Itchett, who didn't even rise at Doremus's entrance, nor listen when Doremus gave his opinion of the new makeup of the rural correspondence pages. That was an apostasy harder to endure than Shad Ledoux's, for Shad had always been rustically certain that Doremus was a fool, almost as bad as real city folks, while Doc Itchett had once appreciated the tight joints and smooth surfaces and sturdy bases of Doremus's craftsmanship. Day on day he waited. So much of a revolution for so many people is nothing but waiting. That is one reason why tourists rarely see anything but contentment in a crushed population. Waiting and its brother death seem so contented. For several days now, in late February, Doremus had noticed the insurance man. He said he was a Mr. Dimmick, a Mr. Dimmick of Albany. He was a gray and tasteless man in gray and dusty and wrinkled clothes, and his pop eyes stared with meaningless fervor. All over town you met him, at the four drug stores, at the shoeshine parlor, and he was always droning, "My name is Dimmick, Mr. Dimmick of Albany, Albany, New York. I wonder if I can interest you in a wonderful new form of life insurance policy. Wonderful." But he didn't sound as though he himself thought it was very wonderful. He was a pest. He was always dragging himself into some unwelcoming shop, and yet he seemed to sell few policies, if any. Not for 2 days did Doremus perceive that Mr. Dimmick of Albany managed to meet him an astonishing number of times a day. As he came out of the Wessex, he saw Mr. Dimmick leaning against a lamppost, ostentatiously not looking his way, yet 3 minutes later and 2 blocks away, Mr. Dimmick trailed after him into the Vertmont Pool and Tobacco headquarters and listened to Doremus's conversation with Tom Aiken about fish hatcheries. Doremus was suddenly cold. He made it a point to sneak uptown that evening and saw Mr. Dimmick talking to the driver of a Beulah Montpelier bus with an intensity that wasn't in the least gray. Doremus glared. Mr. Dimmick looked at him with watery eyes, croaked, "'Evening, Mr. Doremus. Like to talk to you about insurance sometime when you got the time,' and shuffled away. Later, Doremus took out and cleaned his revolver, said, "'Oh, rats,' and put it away. He heard a ring as he did so, and went downstairs to find Mr. Dimmick sitting on the oak hat rack in the hall, rubbing his hat.
"'I'd like to talk to you, if you ain't too busy,' whined Mr. Dimmick. "'All right, go in there, sit down. "'Anybody hear us?' "'No, what of it?'
Mr. Dimmick's grayness and lassitude fell away. His voice was sharp. "'I think your local corpos are onto me. Got the hustle. I'm from Walt Trowbridge. You probably guessed. I've been watching you all week, asking about you. You've got to be Trowbridge's and our representative here. Secret war against the corpos. The NU, the new underground, we call it. Like secret underground that got the slaves into Canada before the Civil War. 4 divisions, printing propaganda, distributing it, collecting and exchanging information about corpo outrages, smuggling suspects into Canada or Mexico. Of course, you don't know one thing about me. I may be a corpo spy. But look over these credentials and telephone your friend Mr. Sampson of the Burlington Paper Company. God's sake, be careful. Wire may be tapped. Ask him about me on the grounds you're interested in insurance. He's one of us. You're going to be one of us. Now phone."
Doremus telephoned to Sampson. "Say, Ed, is a fellow named Dimmick, kind of weedy-looking, pop-eyed fellow, all right? Shall I take his advice on insurance?" "Yes,
Works for Wallbridge. Sure, you can ride along with him. I'm riding.
Chapter 26. The Informer composing room closed down at 11 in the evening, for the paper had to be distributed to villages 40 miles away, and did not issue a later city edition. Dan Wilgus, the foreman, remained after the others had gone, setting a Minuteman poster which announced that there would be a grand parade on March 9th, and, incidentally, that President Windrip was defying the world. Dan stopped, looked sharply about, and tramped into the storeroom. In the light from a dusty electric bulb, the place was like a tomb of dead news, with ancient red and black posters of Scotland county fairs and proofs of indecent limericks pasted on the walls. From a case of 8-point, once used for the setting of pamphlets but superseded by a monotype machine, Dan picked out bits of type from each of several compartments, wrapped them in scraps of print paper, and stored them in the pocket of his jacket. The raped type boxes looked only half-filled, and to make up for it, he did something that should have shocked any decent printer, even if he were on strike. He filled them up with type not from another 8-point case, but with old 10-point. Daniel, the large and hairy, thriftily pinching the tiny types, was absurd as an elephant playing at being a hen. He turned out the lights on the third floor and clumped downstairs. He glanced in at the editorial rooms. No one was there save Doc Itchett, in a small circle of light that through the visor of his eyeshade cast a green tint on his unwholesome face. He was correcting an article by the titular editor, Ensign Emil Staubmeier, and he snickered as he carved it with a large black pencil. He raised his head, startled.
"Hello, Doc."
"Hello, Dan. Staying late?"
"Yeah, just finished some job work. Good night."
"Say, Dan, do you ever see old Jessup these days?"
"Don't know when I've seen him, Doc." "Oh, yes, I ran into him at the Rexall store a couple days ago."
"Still as sour as ever about the regime?"
"Oh, he didn't say anything. Darned old fool. Even if he don't like all the brave boys in uniform, he ought to see the chief is here for keeps, by golly."
"Certainly ought to. And it's a swell regime. Fellow can get ahead in newspaper work now and not be held back by a bunch of snobs that think they're so doggone educated just because they went to college."
"That's right. Well, hell with Jessup and all the old stiffs. Good night, Doc."
Dan and Brother Itchett unsmilingly gave the MM salute, arms held out. Dan thumped down to the street and homeward. He stopped in front of Billy's bar in the middle of a block and put his foot up on the hub of a dirty old Ford to tie his shoelace. As he tied it, after having untied it, he looked up and down the street, emptied the bundles in his pockets into a battered sap bucket on the front seat of the car, and majestically moved on. Out of the bar came Pete Vuitton, a French-Canadian farmer who lived up on Mount Terror. Pete was obviously drunk. He was singing the prehistoric ditty, "Highly High Low," in what he conceived to be German, viz., "Bei uns geht's immer, je longer, je slimmer." He was staggering so that he had to pull himself into the car, and he steered in fancy patterns till he had turned the corner. Then he was amazingly and suddenly sober, and amazing was the speed with which the Ford clattered out of town. Pete Vuitton wasn't a very good secret agent. He was a little obvious, but then Pete had been a spy for only 1 week. In that week, Dan Wilgus had 4 times dropped heavy packages into a sap bucket in the Ford. Pete passed the gate to Buck Titus's domain, slowed down, dropped the sap bucket into a ditch, and sped home. Just at dawn, Buck Titus, out for a walk with his 3 Irish wolfhounds, kicked up the sap bucket and transferred the bundles to his own pocket. And next afternoon, Dan Wilgus, in the basement of Buck's house, was setting up, in 8-point, a pamphlet entitled
How many people have the Corpos murdered? It was signed Spartan, and Spartan was one of several pen names of Mr. Doremus Jessup. They were all the ringleaders of the local chapter of the New Underground, rather glad when once, on his way to Buck's, Dan was searched by M.M.'s unfamiliar to him, and on him was found no printing material, nor any documents more incriminating than cigarette papers. The Corpos had made a regulation licensing all dealers in printing machinery and paper, and compelling them to keep lists of purchasers, so that except by bootlegging it was impossible to get supplies for the issuance of treasonable literature. Dan Wilgus stole the type. Dan and Doremus and Julian and Buck together had stolen an entire old hand-printing press from the informer basement, and the paper was smuggled from Canada by that veteran bootlegger, John Polycop, who rejoiced at being back in the good old occupation of which repeal had robbed him. It is doubtful whether Dan Wilgus would ever have joined anything so divorced as this from the time clock and the office cuspidors, out of abstract indignation at Windrip or County Commissioner Ledoux. He was moved to sedition partly by fondness for Doremus, and partly by indignation at Doc Itchett, who publicly rejoiced because all the printers' unions had been sunk in the governmental confederations, or perhaps because Doc jeered at him personally on the few occasions, not more than once or twice a week, when there was tobacco juice on his shirt front. Dan grunted to Doremus,
"All right, boss, I guess maybe I'll come in with you. And say, when we get this man's revolution going, let me drive the tumbrel with Doc in it. Say, remember Tale of Two Cities? Good book. Say, how about getting out a humorous life of Windrip? You'd just have to tell the facts."
Buck Titus, pleased as a boy invited to go camping, offered his secluded house, and in especial, its huge basement for the headquarters of the New Underground, and Buck, Dan, and Doremus made their most poisonous plots with the assistance of hot rum punches at Buck's fireplace. The Fort Beulah cell of the N.U., as it was composed in mid-March, a couple of weeks after Doremus had founded it, consisted of himself, his daughters, Buck, Dan, Lorinda, Julian Falk, Dr. Olmsted, John Polycop, Father Parafix, and he argued with the agnostic Dan, the atheist Polycop, more than ever he had with Buck, Mrs. Henry Veder, whose farmer husband was in Trianon concentration camp, Harry Kinderman, the dispossessed Jew, Mungo Kitterick, that most un-Jewish and un-socialistic lawyer, Pete Vutong and Daniel Babcock, farmers, and some dozen others, the Reverend Mr. Falk, Emma Jessup and Mrs. Candy were more or less unconscious tools of the N.U. But whoever they were, of whatever faith or station, Doremus found in all of them the religious passion he had missed in the churches. And if altars, if windows of many-colored glass had never been peculiarly holy objects to him, he understood them now as he gloated over such sacred trash as scarred type and a creaking hand press. Once it was Mr. Dimmock of Albany again, once another insurance agent, who guffawed at the accidental luck of insuring Shad Ledoux's new Lincoln. Once it was an Armenian peddling rugs, once Mr. Sampson of Burlington, looking for pine slashing for paper pulp. But whoever it was, Doremus heard from the New Underground every week. He was busy as he had never been in newspaper days, and happy as on youth's adventure in Boston. Humming and most cheerful, he ran the small press, with the hearty bump-bump-bump of the foot treadle, admiring his own skill as he fed in the sheets. Lorinda learned from Dan Wilgus to set type, with more fervor than accuracy about EI and IE. Emma and Sissy and Mary folded news sheets and sewed up pamphlets by hand, all of them working in the high old brick-walled basement that smelled of sawdust and lime and decaying apples. Aside from pamphlets by Spartan and by Anthony B. Susan, who was Lorinda, except on Fridays, Their chief illicit publication was Vermont Vigilance, a four-page weekly, which usually had only two pages, and, such was Doremus's unfettered liveliness, came out about three times a week. It was filled with reports smuggled to them from other NU cells, and with reprints from Walt Trowbridge's Lance for Democracy, and from Canadian, British, Swedish, and French papers, whose correspondence in America got out by long-distance telephone, news which Secretary of Education McGoblin, head of the government press department, spent a good part of his time denying. An English correspondent sent news of the murder of the president of the University of Southern Illinois, a man of 72 who was shot in the back while trying to escape out of the country, by long-distance telephone to Mexico City, from which the story was relayed to London. Doremus discovered that neither he nor any other small citizen had been hearing 1/100th of what was going on in America. Windrip and Company had, like Hitler and Mussolini, discovered that a modern state can, by the triple process of controlling every item in the press, breaking up at the start any association which might become dangerous, and keeping all the machine guns, artillery, armored automobiles, and aeroplanes in the hands of the government, dominate the complex contemporary population better than had ever been done in medieval days, when rebellious peasantry were armed only with pitchforks and goodwill, but the state was not armed much better. Dreadful, incredible information came into Doremus, until he saw that his own life, and Sissy's and Lorinda's and Buck's, were unimportant accidents. In North Dakota, two would-be leaders of the farmers were made to run in front of an MM automobile through February drifts, till they dropped breathless, were beaten with a tire pump till they staggered on, fell again, then were shot in the head, their blood smearing the prairie snow. President Windrip, who was apparently becoming considerably more jumpy than in his old brazen days, saw two of his personal bodyguards snickering together in the anteroom of his office and, shrieking, snatching an automatic pistol from his desk, started shooting at them. He was a bad marksman. The suspects had to be finished off by the pistols of their fellow guards. A crowd of young men, not wearing any sort of uniforms, tore the clothes from a nun on the station plaza in Kansas City and chased her, smacking her with bare hands. The police stopped them after a while. There were no arrests. In Utah, a non-Mormon county commissioner staked out a Mormon elder on a bare rock where, since the altitude was high, the elder at once shivered and felt the glare rather bothersome to his eyes, since the commissioner had thoughtfully cut off his eyelids first. The government press releases made much of the fact that the torturer was rebuked by the district commissioner and removed from his post. It did not mention that he was reappointed in a county in Florida. The heads of the reorganized steel cartel, a good many of whom had been officers of steel companies in the days before Windrip, entertained Secretary of Education McGoblin and Secretary of War Luthorne with an aquatic festival in Pittsburgh. The dining room of a large hotel was turned into a tank of rose-scented water, and the celebrants floated in a gilded Roman barge. The waitresses were naked girls, who amusingly swam to the barge holding up trays and, more often, wine buckets. Secretary of State Lee Saracen was arrested in the basement of a handsome boys' club in Washington on unspecified charges by a policeman who apologized as soon as he recognized Saracen and released him, and who that night was shot in his bed by a mysterious burglar. Albert Einstein, who had been exiled from Germany for his guilty devotion to mathematics, world peace, and the violin, was now exiled from America for the same crimes. Mrs. Leonard Nimitz, wife of a congressional pastor in Lincoln, Nebraska, whose husband had been sent to concentration camp for a pacifist sermon, was shot through the door and killed when she refused to open to an MM raiding section looking for seditious literature. In Rhode Island, the door of a small Orthodox synagogue in a basement was locked from the outside after thin glass containers of carbon monoxide had been thrown in. The windows had been nailed shut, and anyway, the 19 men in the congregation did not smell the gas until too late. They were all found slumped to the floor, beards sticking up. They were all over 60. Tom Krell, but